So I have a couple of questions. Did you have a good feast?
Yes.
I can't hear you. Was it the best feast ever? It was good, kind of. Yeah. I mean, you sound really convincing today. In Walnut Creek, I think we had a really good time. The surveys say that, but I had an older gentleman. We had the contest, Joe? I think 63 years, was that the, I think Aaron Dean, yeah. Aaron Dean, 67, and then we had the Schmidts. So Mr. Schmidt came up to me and said, you know, John, he said, I have to tell you, this is the best feast I've had in 67 years. And I said, okay, well, that's really nice of you to say that. But I think, I mean, we've had the saying, this was the best feast ever. But I think what happens is the memory of the previous feast kind of fades into the background, and the reality of the celebration in the current year makes it feel like the best feast. But the other thing that I think we should note is I don't remember a feast, and again, maybe that's just me not remembering it, when so many people had challenges being sick, going to the feast. I mean, really glad to see Cho here today, because he had a really rough time. But that wasn't the only case. I mean, we had Pam in the hospital. We had Todd was sick. But at least in Walnut Creek, I think everybody finally got there. Etta got there. So I think it shouldn't surprise us that challenges happen around the feasts. I mean, we've said that for years. We've all got our stories, pre-feast trials, pre-Passover in particular. But that's not what I want to dwell on this afternoon. Now, I have my handy-dandy Celebrating the Feast and Community notebook, and I'm looking out across here. I think it looks like everybody's got a piece of paper. So today you need a piece of paper. We're going to do something that maybe we haven't done before, maybe you have done it before. But the title and what we want to do is to make a post-feast covenant. A post-feast covenant. So you're going to need a piece of paper. You're going to write up on top, my post-feast covenant. And we'll get to that. And I'm going to show you where this is drawn from. Let's go to the biblical record of the best feast ever. Nehemiah chapter 8 in verse 17. So the whole congregation of those who had returned from captivity made booth and sat under the booth, for since the days of Joshua the son of Nun, until that day, the children of Israel had not done so. I mean, this is a remarkable statement. During that entire time, there were luminaries that are enumerated in Hebrews chapter 11. And yet, Nehemiah documents that in all that time, there had never been a feast as great, as good, as best as this feast. And they say that, and it says here that there was very great gladness. And also, day by day, from the first day until the last day, he read from the book of the law of God, and he kept the feast 7 days. And on the eighth day, there was a sacred assembly according to the prescribed manner. And that's a remarkable statement, but in the next verse, in the very next verse, or the next chapter, the scrolls really aren't broken up, on the 24th day of the month. Now, in the seventh month, you have the Feast of Trumpets on the first day of the seventh month, and then on the 15th, the Feast of Tabernacles starts. And it goes for 8 days, so that gets you to the 23rd. In the next verse, it says, now on the 24th day of this month, the children of Israel were assembled with fasting in sackcloth, and it was dust on their heads. So let's hold that thought. And I just want to give you a little bit of context of what happened leading up to that. If you go to the first chapter of Nehemiah, and I do the context because I think it's important for us to recognize that there is nothing new under the sun. And that the dynamics and the challenges that Israel faced are not that different from what we are confronted with today. So if you go to Nehemiah chapter 1, we find there, well, I'll turn there. I'm just going to read a couple excerpts. Nehemiah, it says here in verse 5, "And I said, I pray, Lord God of heaven, O great and awesome God, you who keep your covenant and mercy with those who love you and observe your commandments." The observance of commandments was about as popular back then as it is now. Okay? "Please let your ear be attentive and your eyes be open, that you may hear the prayer of your servant, which I pray before you now, day and night, for the children of Israel, your servants, and confess the sins of the children of Israel, which we have sinned against you. Both my father's house and I have sinned." It is that rare occasion in history when people come before the Lord and say, "I have sinned." Those rare occasions, you know, this is one of them. Daniel, remarkably, of whom no negative thing is recorded. Daniel's the only biblical personality that I know of which there's not recorded, you know, that he lied about his wife or murdered someone to be able to get another wife. And it just, you know, you have luminaries of God that made some huge mistakes. But when Daniel prayed his prayer, and this would have been prior to Nehemiah praying, he said, "I have sinned." And it's at these occasions in history where remarkable things happen. And Nehemiah's was no exception. He said, "I have sinned." You know, in the New Testament, when the audience of the New Testament church on the day of Pentecost was cut to their heart, they said, "Men and brethren, what shall we do?" I mean, it's just rare when I say, you know, "Just tell me. Just tell me what to do. And I'll do it." Nehemiah was at that spot. But then things begin to happen. I'll just give you a quick rundown. In chapter 2, Nehemiah is granted leave from King Artaxerxes to go back to Jerusalem. That was a remarkable thing to be granted. And resources were sent with him. In chapter 3, he reviews and starts rebuilding the law. And in chapter 4, the wall has to get defended against the enemies. And in chapter 5, he recognizes the oppression that the Israelites were doing to their fellow Israelites. I mean, they were enslaving their own people. And in chapter 6, there was conspiracy against Nehemiah. Now, we don't have any conspiracies today. We just have theories, right? Except that it seems sometimes that the theories about conspiracy are more true than the truth that we are told that we have to believe. I'm just surveying this very quickly so that we recognize that there is, in fact, nothing new under the sun. And the observance of God's way worked back then, and it works today. In chapter 7, the wall was completed. And then we get to chapter 8. The immediate context to the best feast ever. I want to read a couple of verses here just to highlight how they got there. "Now all the people gathered together as one man on the open square that was in front of the water gate, and he took Ezra the scribe to bring the book of the law of Moses, which the Lord had commanded to Israel." I always find it remarkable. I mean, this was written over 2,000 years ago. The detail. The people were gathered together as one man in the open square in front of the water gate. I mean, that archaeology can document that that existed. And Ezra the scribe came, and he got the law of Moses, which the Lord had commanded Israel. So Ezra the priest brought the law before the congregation of men and women, and all who could hear with understanding on the first day of the seventh month. all who could hear with understanding. Young people, listen to that. You know, they were gathered as one man. This involved everybody, old and young. And young people can understand. So Ezra the priest brought the law before the congregation of men and women, and all who could hear was understanding. Verse 3. And then he read from it in the open square that was in front of the water gate, from morning until midday, before the men and women and those who could understand, and the ears of all the people were attentive to the book of the law. I mean, this kind of flies into the face of today's short attention span culture. From morning until midday. Now, I misspoke, and I stand corrected. I misspoke at the Feast of Tabernacles. I said, well, you know, 9 o'clock to noon, morning to midday. And I think I was listening to myself. Sometimes I have to listen to myself to find out what I actually said. And if I remember correctly, then, of course, you have to remember. But I said, you know, the Amish had this right, you know, this part right, you know, sit on a hard bench for 4 hours and smile when you're not asleep. And when you're not, Freeman will know about this, the kids will get a kick out of this. So what I did to entertain myself is it was in the barn, so we caught flies. We caught flies, but you don't just catch them. We abuse them. So that they don't fly away, we would pull out their wings, okay? And then pull out a hair from your head and make a collar and take them on a walk. So just sharing a little bit of, you know, what to do when the sermon is boring, which usually they were. So unfortunately, I don't know if we have any flies here that you can, you know, de-wing and then put a collar on them and take them on a walk. You know, you walk them down the bench and they walk them back up my leg and up and down and wherever you could go. Let's see, how did we get to that? All right, Nehemiah chapter 8. Continuing, in all seriousness, in verse 8, so they read distinctly from the book of the law of God, and they gave the sense and helped them to understand the reading. And Nehemiah, who was the governor, and Ezra the priest and scribe, and the Levites who taught the people, said to all the people, this day is holy to the Lord your God. Do not mourn nor weep, for all the people wept when they heard the words of the law. There was a huge emotional impact in the reading of the law, which had promise and teaching for their specific people, and they recognized that they had not followed through. But the remarkable thing here is that they said to them, do not mourn. Do not mourn. The takeaway here, I think, is that we need to choose joy over emotion, or perhaps stated better, we need to choose to do the right thing even when it doesn't feel right. And in this case, it was a really positive thing. What felt right to do was to mourn and weep and cry out at how badly that they had sinned. But the command said, rejoice. They said to them, go your way, eat the fat, drink the sweet, send portions to those for whom nothing is prepared, for this day is holy to our Lord. Do not sorrow, for the joy of the Lord is your strength. So the Levites quieted all the people, say, be still, for the day is holy, do not be grieved. This is the day of trumpets. This is when that happened. And all the people went their way to eat and drink and to send portions and to rejoice greatly because they understood the words that were declared to them. I mean, to their credit, they did for once what God's word commanded. And then we get to the second day. This would have been the second day of the month. This, if you look at it, on the seventh month of that year, they basically, in one way or the other, were either reading the law, celebrating a feast, or assembling the 8 days, or as we will get to, repenting for days. I mean, this was an enormous revival that happened, and the underlying attitude, I think, is captured right here in these next several verses. On the second day, the heads of the fathers' houses of all the people, with the priests and the Levites, were gathered to Ezra the scribe in order to understand the words of the law. So now they got together and they said, oh, wait a minute, you know, what? How are we going to walk this out? And they found written in the book of the law, which the Lord had commanded by Moses, that the children of Israel should dwell in booths during the feast of the seventh month, and that they should announce and proclaim in all their cities and in Jerusalem, saying, go out to the mountain and bring olive branches, and branches of the olive trees, and myrtle branches, and palm branches, and branches of leafy trees to make booth, as it is written. Now, if you go back to Leviticus and you read the words that they were reading, I mean, they embellished this a little bit. I mean, when I say embellished, all of the trees and the branches and stuff that are listed here are not listed in Leviticus. So it was the materials that were available to build a temporary dwelling at their location, which the marginal reference indicates was the word booth. But here's the attitude. Then the people went out and brought them and made themselves booth. They read it and they did it. I mean, do you know how unusual that is? When you think, how, you know, when I read it and I put my name there, you know, I ask myself, how often do I then actually do it? Isn't it more common, don't we all admit? You say, well, you know, I'm not sure that quite means what it says. You know, it's a little bit uncomfortable to do that. You know, I might look odd or, you know, keeping the Sabbath. I mean, that's not part of our community and culture, you know. I kind of like to not do that because, I mean, it interferes with my lifestyle. They read it. They did it. And notice each one on the roof of his house or in their courtyards or the courts of the house of God and in the open square of the water gate and in the open square of the gate of Ephraim. So what we see here is there was a lot of latitude into the how of the building of the booth. They read it, and they went out and got it, and they built booths all over the place. I presume from the context here of all shapes and sizes. Because there's no prescription that it has to be 8 feet by 8 feet and 8 feet tall. And that it has to have a lattice and this. Those were all ordinances that were added later. The remarkable thing that I find is that the words or principles that have had the most impact down through time have been those simple and profound prescriptions. If you look at Leviticus chapter 23, the prescribed manner of the Festival of Tabernacles, only a couple verses. You look at the Declaration of Independence, for example. It's a relatively short document that has had enormous impact on Western civilization over the past 200 and some years. And today, you know, the legislature passes bills that are thousands of pages. And whenever you do that, I mean, it just becomes rigor and drudgery and it doesn't work. God was more interested, I believe, and the outcome of very great gladness was more because of the attitude that if I read it, I'm going to do it, than the exact prescription of the temporary dwelling. So the whole congregation of those who had returned from the captivity made booth and sat under the booth, for since the days of Joshua the son of Nun, until that day the children of Israel had not done so, and there was very great gladness. We've read that before. And here's where we get the direction for the celebration of the Feast of Tabernacles. And also day by day, from the first day until the last day, he read from the book of the law of God, and they kept the feast 7 days, and on the eighth day there was a sacred assembly according to the prescribed manner. They did it every day, from light of the morning until midday. That's what it actually says. I don't know that I actually clarified that. 6-hour services. You want to try that out? How many volunteers, okay? I'm not, by the way, suggesting that. But what I do think we need to be cognizant of is we need each other. There is the command to rest. There's the command to keep the Sabbath holy. And there is the command to convoke. And I know from experience in Germany in some areas, there weren't enough resources to have a weekly Sabbath service. And the outcome is not good. Most people lost all their children to the world. And I say that because we are in a contest of a stream of media that gets bombarded at us. And we need one day in seven. We need immersion in God's word. Or we're going to have immersion in something else. That's one of the reasons there was great gladness here. But now we get to the 24th, which is, this is remarkable. After they had read the law from the first day to the 15th and figured out, okay, this is what we're going to do. And after they had kept the feast, on the 24th day, the day after, it says here, and now on the 24th day of this month, the children of Israel were assembled, was fasting in sackcloth with dust on their heads. I always wondered what sackcloth back then looked like. I mean, when you talk about sackcloth, I think of a burlap feed sack. And somehow, I think in biblical times, it was worse. But if you ever tried to wear a burlap sack, it ain't very comfortable. Then those Israelites' lineage separated themselves from all foreigners, and they stood and confessed their sins and iniquities of their fathers. And they stood up in their place and read from the book of the law, their God, 1/4 of the day. And for another 1/4 of the day, they confessed and worshiped the Lord their God. Half days. Now, what it doesn't say here, it says that it started on the 24th day of the month. I don't know for how long that went. But what we do know is what they confessed, because it's recorded. Nehemiah recorded it here, and I want to get some highlights. Verse 6, they confessed that you alone are the Lord. You have made heaven, the heaven of heavens with all its host, the earth and all the things on it, the seas and all that is in them, and you preserve them all. The host of heaven worships you. They confessed that to be true. Is that relevant today? I submit that it is. Because science, you know, right now, we've been, how many times have you heard in the last year and a half, follow the science? Until the science does not follow the narrative, then you don't follow the science. But let's set that, that's the conspiracy in which we live. But the reality is that we as a people no longer confess as they did that the Lord made the heavens and the earth. We have a better theory. Science has concluded that it came to be through evolution. You see, it's up to date. Verse 7, you are the Lord God who chose Abram and brought him out of Ur of the Chaldees, and you gave him the name Abraham. You found his heart faithful before you, and made a covenant with him. As we walk down through here, as they confess, the word you keeps coming up. You did this. You found him faithful. You saw the affliction of our fathers in Egypt. You showed signs and wonders against Pharaoh. And you divided the sea before them, so that they went through the midst of the sea on dry land, and their persecutors you threw into the deep, as a stone into the mighty waters. Moreover, you led them by day with a cloudy pillar, and by night with a pillar of fire, to give them light on the road which they should travel. All of these things they confessed that God had reliably done. Then we get to verse 16. But they, notice the pronoun change, but they and our fathers acted proudly, hardened their necks, and did not heed your commands. They refused to obey, and they were not mindful of your wonders that you did among them, but they hardened their necks in their rebellion. They appointed a leader to return to their bondage. But you are God, ready to pardon, gracious and merciful, slow to anger, abundant in kindness, and did not forsake them. I mean, the contrast here is stark. You did all these things, and we confess it. They did not do this or acted rebelliously, and God continued to be reliable and merciful and kept this covenant. Verse 19, yet in your manifold mercies you did not forsake them in the wilderness. The pillar of the cloud did not depart from them by day to lead them on the road, nor the pillar of fire by night. And you also gave your good spirit to instruct them, and did not withhold your manna from their mouth, and gave them water for their thirst. Did you notice that? It says here that he gave them his good spirit. I mean, that's an interesting theological question. Because, you know, generally we make the broad brush statement, well, they didn't have the Holy Spirit back then, you know. Well, he says he gave them his good spirit. 40 years you sustained them in the wilderness so that they lacked nothing. Their clothes did not wear out and their feet did not swell. I always say that you can learn everything you need to know about human nature and organizational development and stuff by looking at the story of the Israelites leaving Egypt and going to the Promised Land. It's all there. I mean, look at this. The notion that if you just treat people well, they're going to respond in kind, it's just not true. Because they were treated well, but they never really got Egypt out of their heads. That was the fundamental problem. They appointed a leader to go back. Notice in verse 22, moreover, you gave them kingdoms and nations and divided them into districts. So they took the possession of the land of Sihon and the land of the king of Heshbon and the land of Og, the king of Bashan. You also multiplied their children. So the people went, in verse 24, in and possessed the land. Verse 26, you know, we have all these coordinating conjunctions is not a nevertheless, in verse 26, they were disobedient and rebelled against you and cast your law behind their backs. I mean, all, you know, if you think about it, this is what they did for a quarter of a day. They confessed. This is a remarkable recounting of what occurred. Then we get to verse 32. I mean, I'm not going to read everything here. You can do that. Nevertheless, verse 32, our God, the great, the mighty, the awesome God who keeps covenant and mercy, do not let all the trouble seem small before you, that came upon us, our princes and our kings, our priests and our prophets and our fathers, on all your people from the days of the kings of Assyria until this day. You know, now therefore, you know, I mentioned, you know, making a covenant. This is resolution type language. Now therefore, our God, the great and mighty, you drop down to, they list, you know, all the things that have befallen us and how you've dealt faithfully and we have done wickedly. Neither our kings nor our princes, our priests nor our fathers have kept your law nor heeded your commandments and your testimonies. I mean, that is as true today as it was back then. Most of our fathers didn't keep the feasts of the Lord. You know, that creates we follow the structures of our culture. You know, we moan and complain and murmur like the Israelites did about YouTube, about the woke culture, about Facebook, about, you know, all this canceling, and then we continue to use the platforms which enables them to continue to do their thing, you know, myself included. I'm just pointing that out. Because we were in a culture, and until we change the structures, our culture that we embrace will not change. Everything will stay the same. Verse 38, and because of all this, we make a sure covenant and write it, and our leaders and our Levites and our priests will seal it, sign it. So here's my proposition. I've written it down. Actually, I made a list on this side of all the topics of sermons. I haven't done the sermonettes. I plan to do that as well. At the feast in Walnut Creek. I'll give you a sampling. That's the why and how. What does it take? Interventions from God. Excellent sermon. Never heard this before. Looking at the feasts of the Lord as interventions from God. Makes sense. Home for the homeless. Having Jesus as the center of our family. Christ the servant. And you shall live and reign. Arise, lift your skirts and run. And my name was used in vain, I would have you know. Actually, I was, ironically, I didn't hear it because I had just gone to the porta potty to lift my skirt when he went ahead and did this. I hate to tell you this. You can't make that stuff up. I mean, it's true. It's what happened. I had to ask. I could vaguely hear my name being used through the barrier of the porta potty. And I had to found out that he was talking about me lifting my skirt. Now, think about it. What people are willing to do to me is just amazing. The only fair solution, mercy for the masses in three dimensions. That's a lot of stuff in 8 days. It's a lot of stuff. But we walk away from it. Okay. So, the top here I've written, my post-feast covenant. I challenge all of you to do the same. As we've talked about, okay, the post-feast blues, the post-feast depression, the post-feast down. So anything we can do to kind of extend it. And I've drawn this from, so I've given you the title, but I didn't make this up. Let's look at Nehemiah chapter 10. Let's start reading a verse. We'll read verse 1. I'm not going to read all these names. Again, I'm impressed by the detail. And archaeologists continue to dig up, you know, signet rings and other things that where these names are enumerated. So we know it to be true. Now, those who placed their seal on the document... you know, there's something about documenting something that does something psychologically and ensures that it gets done. So I just did a little bit of cursory research. I knew this to be true. 42% people who write down their goals, okay? I'm going to do this and I want to do that. And I know this, I've done this. I know this to be true. People who write down their goals are 42% more likely to actually achieve them than those who don't. Yeah, I haven't got a goal. Well, no, you don't have a goal. What you've got is a notion, not a goal, because you haven't written it down. It's also true, and I don't know what the number is, if you write it down and then you tell somebody else, the number goes up significantly again. I mean, what you're doing is you're kind of leveraging human nature. Because if I tell you that I'm going to sing special music, okay, you know, there's you know, I've really got myself into a predicament here. I'm going to be embarrassed one way or the other, right? But when you tell somebody else, it elevates the level of commitment. Because we don't like to let people down. I mean, that's a good part of human nature. Most people, if they're somewhat normal, don't like to let people down. So they do stuff they're committed to. Forbes, in another article entitled "Neuroscience Explains Why You Need to Write Down Goals." And in that article, it talked about the fact that there is a connection neurologically. When I take my pen, I was going to say the pen from the feast in Walnut Creek, but I don't have one. I take my pen, and you know, I press it between two fingers. I take paper, and I write it down. It actually has a greater neurological effect than keyboarding. Because when you're keyboarding, you're doing it, so you still have the tactile interaction. And I'm just kind of wondering how stupid we're going to get when voice recognition reaches its full potential. You know, and they're like, I can't remember how to get to Cho and Hillary's house. You know, been there I don't know how many times. Because guess what? You just say, navigate to blah, 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 Seneca Street, you know. And off you go, okay, let me think, you know, and you're listening to a woman tell you which way to turn, which is interesting. Man up, you know. You know, have you ever thought about the fact that the defaults on all of the GPSs is a woman? It is. Now, I'm already in trouble, so just you know, I can take it, but it's true. You can change it. Somebody told me to have some Englishman speak to you in British prose and make it sound a little bit more. But because we can now just say navigate, we don't need to remember all this stuff. And okay, you know, there is, you know, hopefully we engage our minds into more important tasks. If that's the case, which I doubt, then that's fine. In other ways, we continue to go down a path. So if we look at verse 28, now the rest of the people, the priests and the Levites and the gatekeepers and the singers and those who had separated themselves from the people of the lands to the law of the God, their wives and their sons and their daughters and everyone who had knowledge and understanding, they joined their brethren and their nobles and entered into a curse and an oath, this was part of what was written in a document, to walk in God's law, which was given by Moses, the servant of God, to observe and to do all the commandments of the Lord our God and his ordinances and his statutes. So that's what the covenant made a covenant to do. So I've written here, my post-feast covenant, I, John Miller, do hereby resolve in covenant with God that I will. And because I knew I'd have a high-definition camera pointed at me, I left some blanks there for propriety's sake. I suggest three things. Three things because they said, okay, what are they going? They said, we will walk in God's law, which was given to by Moses, the servant of God, and observe and do all his commandments and his ordinances. And then verse 30, and that we would not give our daughters as wives to the people of the land, nor take their daughters for our sons. The second thing I wrote down here is, I covenant that I will not. One, two, three. You see, because they did both. I mean, they said that they will, and they in verse 30 they said that we would not give our daughters as wives to the people of the land, nor take their daughters for our sons. Now, the question is now today's application. You know, it's too late for me. My daughter is gone, but I'll tell you what I did. When she was 13, I gave her a gold, 14-karat gold heart pendant with a key on it and said, I got the key. When the right man comes around, if he doesn't have the courage to come ask me for the key to your heart, he's not worth it. It actually worked. But then there were the more common discussions that I'd have. I'd say, you know, I will not. I said, if you get involved with a guy that I don't think is good for you, I'm going to stop you. Most of you know Marianne. You can't do that. There's no way. You can't tell me who to marry. You can't prevent me. I said, watch me. And that was the end of the discussion. Oh, I was smart enough that I couldn't prevent it. I knew that, but I had died trying. And she knew that too. And she just wasn't quite sure what Dad might pull out of his creative resources. You see, when we covenant with God, and maybe I'm using that term because that's what they used here. You know, we've had an opportunity. We have invested a lot of money in most cases. Most of us have saved 10% of our income in order to do what most people can't, to celebrate the feasts of the Lord. So now, you know, we have an opportunity. It's really, really simple. Try this. You put down six things, three that you will do, three that you won't do. Don't make it too complicated. Because what happens is, oftentimes, is we write down 100 things that we're going to do. Well, the first thing that happens is you become paralyzed and you can't do anything. So kids, write down one thing that you're going to do and one thing that you're not going to do. Now, you know, think about that. You know, a kid come up with something that they're not going to do? Well, that's a challenge. So if we focus on one or two or three things, you will make much more progress by doing that than to try to do 100 things. It's just the nature, the benefit, and the dynamic of focus. I know it works because, you know, I've tried and failed. I've had a lot of experience. You know, wisdom comes from, what is the saying? Wisdom comes from experience, and wisdom comes from making bad decisions. Experience comes from making bad decisions, something like that. I messed it up. But it's right here embedded in the context of the best feast ever. I'm making a post-feast covenant with God. I hope you do too.